This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Bensana Nolintha was sent from Laos to live in the United States when he was just 12 years old. His parents wanted him to have better opportunities than they did. Bensana moved in with family friends in Greensboro, and there were big hurdles right from the start. I mean, imagine, it's harder to communicate with other kids, and of course he was very lonely. When his younger sister, Vanvisa, followed him to the U.S., he took on a new challenge. He was her support system and her disciplinarian. With time, the siblings found their stride and eventually success. Today, Vansana and Vanvisa are co-owners of Bitamanda Restaurant in Raleigh, and the two partners are two of the partners behind Brewery Bavana right next door. Vansana Nolintha joins us now. Welcome to the program, Van. Good to have you here.
So excited to be here, Frank. Thank you for having me.
You're here now. You recently took a trip back to Laos and experienced a ritual called the Boon. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was an incredible trip. I was in Laos with my sister for 2 weeks, and you know, the end of that trip was also exciting because mom and dad came with us to the States. But I don't remember last time our family had a boon that scale. What a boon is a way of collecting spiritual currency to pass on to our ancestors. And it's really in our tradition back in Laos, when someone passed away, their spirit entered a space that's quite silent and dark, and the only way for that spirit to find light and find direction is through the positivity and through the boon that's conducted by the living. So there is this interconnected web between the living and the dead. So my sister and I were back at home to do this ceremony with our parents to send our positivity and love to our grandparents.
And it's interesting that this is not just do good deeds and it'll be somehow sent to the account. The idea of bringing the community together, making this an intentional event, is important.
Exactly. So it takes a lot of rituals and ceremonies, and it's a major production. It's a week-long production with lots of monks, lots of food, a large space, a large home. So not every family has that kind of opportunity. So when someone in the village or someone in the community is putting together a boon, it's really becoming an invitation for other folks in the community to think about their ancestors and giving them an opportunity to bring contributions to the ceremony to send to their ancestors. You know, all over towns, folks would bring flowers and rice and their grandparents' favorite dishes and come and offer to the monks that our parents invited so that the ancestors could receive those gifts.
Well, it's interesting because that allows everybody to bring according to their own means, but somebody then can provide the space and perhaps a little bit of the the overhead, right?
Yeah.
And then they can come and bring whatever they have. Well, talk more about this relationship with ancestors and also understanding of death and how that plays out and how you understand that within your culture.
Yeah, I think we grew up in a tradition where there's not a separation between, you know, life and death. In fact, there's no Laotian word for death. It's really a Buddhist idea of passing and the different seasons that we arrive at our life and you know, quote unquote death is a part of that transition. So if there's no such thing as death and life goes on, whether that's through the memories or through recipes or through stories that your families are told, it creates this really interesting relationship between what are we doing now and what we will become in the future. I went home with my sister as well about a few years ago to cremate my grandmother. She was 105. Her name is Metau. And, you know, the ceremony was also 7 days. And for 7 days, family members would gather around a casket to tell stories about her lives and also to cook her favorite dishes. And it is in our tradition to keep her company during that 7 days transition from the living into the spirit. And I became a monk for her. It is believed that the saffron color from the monk's robe is one of the things that contribute to the brightness of that light in her journey. So I became a monk. My brother, my nephew, my father, and lots of people So we conducted a 7-day-long ceremony, and at the 7th day, we took her casket to the temple, and we would burn her body,
cremate
her body overnight. And my brother and I would watch the frame, go seeing this tangible thing into ashes. And that, too, was to keep my grandmother company.
Let me interrupt the story just for a moment, because this would not be, if we think of cremation here, it goes into a chamber and you don't see it, but this is something that would be visible to you then.
Exactly.
It's visible as it's
so
as
her
it's
body was adorned with beautiful marigold flowers and jewelries and her favorite, purses and jackets. And my mom would, really put on amazing makeup on her, making sure that she looks her best through her transition. So seeing that prolonged procession and ceremony also, I think, allow a space for healing and reflection. Mm. My brother and I watch her, became ashes, and the morning light came, and all we had was just this pile of black ash. And family members would gather in the morning, and we would all given a stick to go through her ashes and looking for her teeth or bones or jewelries. And it is believed that those things are left behind as protections. And as I was looking through her pile, her life really in a new context, I saw her ring. I'm actually having it on my hand right now. Mm. And everyone, said that I'm her favorite grandchild, and I think that was the last mark to say, yes, he's my favorite.
She proved it.
Yes.
What a fascinating story, because earlier you said, when there's death and you see a death, it's a transition, life goes on, but not in the way that we would maybe use that phrase, life goes on, get over it. Life goes on, and so you're learning to evolve with it, and your life then takes on some of the transformative qualities that not in precisely the same, but it transforms along with these loved ones who are part of your network.
Absolutely, yeah. And especially with being so far away from home, I think that relationship to our ancestors became this constant thread in my life, and thinking about who we are, who we want to become, and how do we make sure that we celebrate and honor the legacy in our new life here in Raleigh that looks very different than that ceremony I just described.
Well, let's talk more about that life before you moved here at 12 years old, and your parents too, and how they came up and their lives in Laos.
Yes. Yeah, life was very different than I came when I was 12 years old. My parents grew up during the war. We call the Vietnam War the American War in Asia. Laos is the most bombed country per capita in our history. Roughly about 2 million tons of bombs were dropped in Laos in nine years, which is roughly about the size of a plane, plane load, every 9 minutes, 24 hours a day for 9 years. I remember my grandparents telling stories of having to dig big giant holes so that their children can hide underground during the day so that American planes wouldn't see movements or any moving lights. And my mom's siblings and her would come out from the holes at night to bathe and to study and to cook. I was just in Laos a couple months ago, and I was asking my mother about her memory of that, and she spoke about it so casually. She was talking about Laotian women wear sin, which is a skirt that's close with a silver pin, and she was talking about her and her friends not allowed to wear the pin because if the planes were to fly through, they would see a reflection. And that would mean the possibility of the whole family being killed. For 9 years, that was their reality. I think my parents grew up under that condition of fear. I think might be the reason why they thought that us leaving and having the opportunity to be here would be a better opportunity. But life was really tremendous. My parents were just generous, kind, loving, passionate, creative folks. back in Laos.
They became school teachers.
Yes, they became school teachers, and you know, we were extremely poor. Mom would, along from teaching, she would, you know, buy bags of beans, she told me, and turn them into bean sprouts and sell them at the market after school. My father would, you know, be with my grandfather and walk around towns and collect metal cans and turn them into lanterns and sell them. We were extremely poor, but my parents have always been extremely hardworking. They eventually opened a hotel of their own, and that was my life before leaving Laos, was living in this hotel and really seeing the impact of hospitality and food as an introduction to our culture.
We're going to continue that conversation and find out how that all happened. And now, one of the rare times ever that I really wish we were on television, because your parents are here and you can see them through the glass in the studio. So every time you mention your mother, you look up, and then I wish we could all see your face as you tell the story and look in your mother's eyes. Vensana Nolintha is the co-owner of Bitamanda Restaurant in Raleigh, partner behind Brewery Bavana right next door. We'll talk more about why he dedicated his first restaurant to his parents just ahead on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, meeting Vensana Nolintha, co-owner of Bitamanda Restaurant in Raleigh, partner behind Brewery Bavana right next door. Vensana was sent to live in the U.S. when he was 12 years old. His sister was not far behind, and they are now both here in the United States, as I say, co-owners of these restaurants. Well, let's talk more about that decision then to send you to the U.S. Your parents, school teachers, entrepreneurs, eventually open a hotel. They're not doing badly in Laos, but they decided it would be best to send you to the U.S. Tell us more.
Yes, I think my parents knew that even knowing English alone could really change someone's life, and they really wanted to make sure that we had that opportunity. It's really fascinating because even though they grew up in war, my grandparents sent all of my mom and her siblings to college. All of them are college graduates, which is really uncommon. So I think in our family, there's a culture of really wanting to make sure that we all have the best chance to succeed. So they secretly work on our visa application, and one day I came home and they say, you are heading to North Carolina.
Wow. What did you think of that?
I think I was young enough to be excited about the possibility. You know, I knew about the States. I saw pictures and postcards, and I don't think neither I nor my parents knew the magnitude of that decision, that it would be 17, 20 years later before our family were whole again.
Yeah, because that was a separation for at least that long. You come to Greensboro to live with family friends. Tell us about that.
Yes, so we had a family that helped sponsor the process in Greensboro. They had restaurants there, so we were helping with bussing tables, doing cashier, and really learn this new life. It was a tremendous time for us, extremely difficult emotionally. My sister came a year after, and, you know, because it took us 6 years before we became citizens, so we didn't have that opportunity to go back to Laos. I left when I was 12 years old, and then I didn't see my parents again until I was 18. So taking care of my sister became my life purpose. And she was so young, and I knew I wanted her to remember home. I knew I wanted her to remember my parents' cooking. I knew that as a young child growing up in the States, I wanted her to feel like mom and dad still love her. So we did everything we could to make sure that she remembers home, and one of those things was cooking for her mom and dad's recipes.
So how much of that did you sort of take with you, and how much of that did you have to recall, you know, kind of scramble to remember what she was doing? How much time did you spend in the kitchen to know?
Yeah. For some reason, you know, I was always that kid that mom and dad say, no, you can't play sport, you should be in the kitchen. So I knew enough coming to the States, and I'm not sure if that was a part of their thinking, that whenever we were going to be away from home, they knew that food was going to be the protector of our life when they're not around. So I think they gave us that treasure a long time ago, of the gift of cooking. But 1998 in Greensboro was very different than Luang Prabang. There was no place to get these ingredients. So we spent a lot of time reimagining mom's recipes.
Now, what was your sister thinking about all this? She may have wanted to integrate and get away from it all, right? I don't know. What was she thinking?
I think that clearly there was a temptation. You know, I came seventh grade, and my sister came a year later to be a seventh grader too. And I think at that time, we wanted to conform. I hated when someone said, you know, would you say something in Laotian, because I want to remove everything from my life that was from my past in a public space. And I want to make sure that my sister, wore Abercrombie. I want to make sure that she knew our U.S. pop songs so that she doesn't stand out, so that she wouldn't be bullied. It wasn't until college, I think, when we both felt like we were giving this gift of being unique and being different.
But this is fascinating, because on the one hand, at home, you do not want her to forget. It's about, they love you, remember home, here's this dish. And then in public, it's it's an entirely different face.
Absolutely. And I think both at home, trying to be fully Laotian, and at school and publicly trying to be fully American, we're both the same, which is survival. And I think that's what parents do. You know, I became my sister's parent, and I want to make sure that she conform at school, and then she remains true to her roots at home, both as a way of healing and trying to make sense of the world and making sure she was safe.
Admirable goals, but you were a pretty rough disciplinarian, I'm told.
I can be very tough. It's all because of love.
Well, if she were here, we'd get her take. But I will. We'll post that on the website. But let's talk about this, because you were able to stay in the U.S. for college because the family that you were living with adopted you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you could stay here. And then you went to NC State.
Yes. I went to NC State for chemical engineering. I think as immigrants, there really aren't too many paths that were considered sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
So it was either going to be a lawyer or a doctor or an engineer. And I went to NC State as chemical engineering, pre-med, until my junior year. And I visited a friend's design studio at NC State and fell in love with the design thinking process, and decided last minute to switch to the design school, and was in that program for a long time.
What were you imagining yourself, or how were you imagining yourself coming out of that?
I think I thought I was going to be a doctor for a long time. And, you know, when I discovered the design school, I felt alive for the first time. Mm. I felt like I was, for the first time, speaking in the language that I was comfortable with, and it felt like inhaling for the first time. Mm. And I think by that time, I was giving myself more permission to not know for a long time. Mm. In fact, I never graduated from the design school at NC State. I had few more studios to take, and I was nominated to represent NC State for a few different fellowship programs. And so I left NC State prematurely and went to Trinity College in Dublin to study international peace and conflict studies for my graduate degree.
Well, talk about that decision.
It was, now looking back, at that time, it was just a series of relationships and reflections and really a quest. But now looking back, I think I wanted to engage with that part of my life growing up, or my parents growing up in a war zone, and really wanting to explore further the impact of war and the construction of peace. Trinity was a tremendous school. We have folks from all over the world engage with the topic of peace, not from the absence of war, but how can we truly construct a community that's based on peace building. My graduate thesis was on the ethics of sight, pertaining to the role of ourselves in relation to seeing something. Are we just a participant? Are we a witness when we see something, particularly with war photography? So I was looking at what happened in Vietnam and the role of the audience in viewing that photo when the girl was running away from the plane. Right. And I came back to the States after that degree, and it was the peak of the recession, and no one was looking for a peace study student at that time.
Dear. Well, talk about that paradox in and of itself is something I'd like to explore, the idea that, you know, the U.S., you and the people of Laos absolutely understood what the United States were doing. The people of the United States for a while didn't, because it was a secret illegal war that we were fighting in Cambodia and Laos. The amount of bombing, you said, that there was more tonnage dropped per capita in Laos than any other country, probably in the century. So what's the idea of what sort of thoughts do you have about Americans coming out of this? Obviously, it was a civil war, and the North Vietnamese were traipsing through Laos, creating a lot of havoc and damage, too. It's not as though only the United States was causing this, but it certainly was causing a great deal of damage and hardship. How did your parents feel about Americans, and how did you feel coming after that?
Yeah, I think that is probably one of the biggest questions that I have, and also a lot of my friends have for my parents when I take them home to Laos, to visit Laos. And I think there's a combination of many things, and mom and dad haven't really fully given me an answer of what that healing process looks like, because they struggle through that process so much. I think, you know, because the war in Laos was never acknowledged, the people of Laos had to move on in order to heal and mend. So there was so much confusion because it wasn't acknowledged. So I think the people of Laos perhaps assigned a blame to different factors. And then it wasn't until recently when we knew that, you know, what happened was pretty intentional. And we were not just a product of this fight with Vietnam. I remember, you know, taking my friends to Laos for the first time. It was a group of 15 of us doing service learning trips in Thailand and visited Laos. And my parents took my friends to this small town, and my friends were like, "It's so fascinating that there's so many ponds in Laos." And
these are like ponds, ponds of water.
Water, yeah. Yes. And that's because of the war. There's so much damage that happened. And for mom and dad to speak about it so peacefully, I think comes from that place of the need to heal long before our government here acknowledged of what happened.
I wonder how much of that is traceable to a conversation we had earlier about the way in which we have to acknowledge the passing of loved ones as a part of a transition, as a part of a process. We never close the door to it. We're constantly processing that. So even if the United States government has never properly acknowledged what it did in Laos, perhaps during the Clinton administration, something close to that.
Yeah.
The people who have a different culture and come from a different understanding of what life and death means, maybe we're able to process that differently.
Yeah, I think their relationship with change, it's a very different thing than us in the West. I think they embrace change to be a natural part of life. And I think for them, if they couldn't do anything to make sense of the war, the only choice they have in order to thrive and raise a family is actually to move on and create a healthy relationship with that war.
So you come to the United States, you start out in chemical engineering, you end up in design, and then peace studies in Trinity College, come back to North Carolina, and you're in the middle of a recession. What do you do?
It was such a tough process, especially as an immigrant. I think we adopted this mentality of, if you work hard, if you show up, if you raise your hand, if you do the things right, you will be okay. I think at least that was the promise. And I think for most of my life, I knew I had to work hard. And coming back from Trinity, I applied to over 300 jobs in a year and get zero offer. I remember applying to, you know, drugstores just to be a cashier at CVS and so on. So my sister and I decided that we were going to go back home to Laos, who spent a summer. Prior to that trip, just to give some perspective, I think every time when we went to Laos, we were travelers, we were visiting mom and dad. I think there was something so remarkable about that trip, in our relationship was that that was the first time since we left that I needed them. I needed their love. I needed their comfort and their reassurance, and needing to be cared for and to hear from someone that things were going to be okay. And even though it was such a hard reason to go back home, I think it perhaps began a different chapter for our family, which is the need to be together again. So I went back to Laos, spent that summer. I will never forget that morning. Our house is right on the Mekong River. I woke up really early to go for a run, and my parents were already up. I can smell the sticky rice, this beautiful jasmine aroma, and mom was chopping something. And that just stuck with me. And I went for a run, and I came back home, and dad was pouring two cups of milk, one warm and one cold, and gave the warm one to my grandmother and the cold one to my mother. And I just remember that that tradition, that ritual, was there 20 years ago before I left home, that, you know, so much of my life, it's still coming from that love and that medium of food being the thing to care for your loved ones. And my sister and I decided at that moment that we were going to open a Laotian restaurant in Raleigh.
Now, again, we're in the midst of a depression. People are not opening restaurants now. They're closing restaurants. So you decide, though, because of this kind of this awakening, this moment that you have about kinship, family, and this human relationship, you come back. Now, so tell me more about that, because it's not an easy. It's also a business decision.
Correct.
Yeah,
I think we were young enough to be so naive. I think if we were more mature, I think we wouldn't have done it. But I think maybe it was very similar to my reaction to discover the design school for the first time and feeling like breathing for the first time, when the idea of cooking Laotian food, telling stories of mom and dad to our new lives and new friends was so overwhelming that, you know, I was so charmed by it and so enchanted by it, I knew I had no choice but to do it. And you're right, it is a very difficult thing to do, opening a restaurant. I remember the first thing we did was going to Barnes & Noble after we landed in Raleigh and bought How to Open a Restaurant for Dummies.
That goodness.
That was our first step. Okay. And financially, it was very difficult as well. So in our tradition in Laos, the way that heritage is passed from family, from generation to generation, is through a piece of land. So when my parents passed away, their plan was to give us a piece of land. And the way that you tend the land and how you care for that land is how you honor your family's legacy. And I called mom and dad and said, you know, if they were to consider giving us a piece of land, we wanted them to do it while they're still alive, because we want them to know how we do what we do with the land. And they decided to sell a piece of land to be the seed money for Bidamanda. So in a way, you know, us cooking papaya salad and mom's pork belly soup is still tending that land. It's just in a different space at a different time. And it is the reason why the name is Bidamanda, not only because the recipes is really based on our memory of missing home and cooking her food, but truly, Bidamanda, it's coming from that place of their life and their heart and their land.
And tell us what that means.
So Bidamanda are Sanskrit terms for father and mother.
And is it are they just sort of, is that the vocabulary, are those the words, or does one say Bidamanda in a way that conveys even more meaning than that?
Yeah, so Bidamanda are ceremony words, though we don't call mom and dad Bidamanda in a casual setting. Yeah. So when we chant or when we meditate, we evoke those two words as a way of showing gratitude to our parents. So in Luang Prabang, we bow six different times before we meditate, and that is the first one is to the Buddha. The second one is the teaching of the Buddha. The third one is the Sangha, which is the community surrounding the teaching. The fourth one is Bida, which is father or father figures in your life. The fifth one is mother, which is mom and mother figures. And the sixth one is to teachers. So those two words have always been really sacred in our understanding of who we are and our responsibility to our community and our families.
We'll talk about how those spiritual values were carried forward and ended up in the kitchen at Bitamanda Restaurant as I talk to one of the co-owners and co-founders, Vansana Nolintha. Just ahead, we'll hear more about his parents' visit from Laos and how he sees himself embracing change as time goes on. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Vansana Nolintha, a Raleigh restaurateur behind Bitamanda Restaurant and Brewery Bhavana in Raleigh. And the restaurants are well known for both their foods and the stories behind them. Bitamanda means father, mother. It's a restaurant that is a tribute to Vansana's parents and his ancestry, as well as his homeland. Brewery Bhavana is an eclectic space filled with a flower shop, bookstore, brewery, and dim sum restaurant. Vansana considers it a dedication to his adopted community in North Carolina. Let's talk more about Bitamanda in particular, because you have a way of even working with your staff and understanding their relationship to you and the restaurant. Talk more about that.
Yes, so when we opened Bitamanda, I was 25 years old. So we knew that we needed help. And I think that it was the goal for how to staff everyone is the relationships. So over time, you know, I remember calling friends to say, would you mind helping with graphic design? Would you mind coming back home and help and being a server and help being a manager? So I think the original group of Bitamanda really helped create this culture based on generosity and compassion and also connect back to my understanding of my parents cooking and why they cook. You know, we growing up so poor, but there were always food on the table. And we wanted to make sure that Bitamanda feels that way, that you know, this is a foreign cuisine. Most folks in the area don't know Laos or have been to Laos. But we want the feeling of arriving at Bitamanda and dining there to be a feeling that's familiar of what it feels like to be in someone's home. And we knew that if we were going to do that work well, then I think we have to really create a culture and a community where our staff truly invest in those connections and see themselves as someone who's capable of curating and facilitating these life sacred moments. You know, we really allow our staff to invest in the relationships and what's happening at the table.
Is it in a practical way? I mean, the restaurant business in the United States, that's the other culture that you're dealing with, and that's the big culture, right?
Yes.
In which you are trying to institute this other one. And it is a notoriously transient mm-hmm. business. The people don't, you know, your servers probably don't see their lives, their futures in serving this way. Maybe some do, but most, I think, are planning to move on. How do you create that kind of a culture or infuse those spiritual values in a very transitory business?
I think that's a great point. I remember this moment maybe 2 years into opening. This moment that changed everything. I have so many conversations with different restaurateurs, and everyone were complaining and talking and sharing this thing about, you know, it's so hard to keep people around. Yeah. It's so hard to staff the restaurant industry. And I had this aha moment that if change was a part of the industry, instead of fighting it, can we actually create an infrastructure that embrace change? And that changed everything for us in terms of recruitment, development. And so when we interview someone or when we hire someone, we don't assume that this person is going to stay for a long time. We ask questions about their lives and what they hope to do in their life and how can Bitamanda and Brewery Bhavana can be a meaningful part of their journey. And I think people genuinely long to feel connected to what they do and wanting to make sure that what they do connects with their life journey. So we get together with our staff really often, asking them to set intentions. And I think when folks realize that what they're doing connects with their journey, I think they stay for as long as it's meaningful to them.
I've got to press you on that because I don't. How does, you know, bringing iced tea to the table connect with the life journey? What kinds of stories have you heard, or how, you know, does that? I can see a lot of eye rolling going on when you first propose that. Somebody there to say, yes, look, I just need enough money to get out this weekend.
Right? Yeah, I completely agree. So every time that we encounter a challenge, let's say we have a table that it's difficult, you know, and a server come back and said, this is really, you know, I need to be angry, this is hard. Yeah. I think first is to validate that feeling. And I think we're constantly talking about empathy and meeting our guests where they are. So how can we turn this moment of discomfort into what is it that I can do to practice the things I want to work on? Let's say if generosity or kindness or patience are something that I want to practice on, helping our staff getting to that place where they see as something that they can do in order to cultivate the skill sets in life. And, you know, I you're absolutely right. 90% of what we do is mundane and technical and not romantic. But I think once people believe in the vision and they know they are part of a belief, I think those things becomes a mechanics that must be in place for us to achieve this higher level. We have our aunt, she's Laotian, in the back. Her name's Donna. She probably has the worst station of the entire kitchen because she's responsible for making spring rolls and papaya salad and the papaya sauce. And every day she comes and then she go back to the very back corner, which doesn't have any window. It's dark. It's tiny. It's just stale. And her role is to, you know, her job responsibility is to make hundreds of spring rolls. And she would, you know, place the protein perfectly at the center of every single spring roll sheets. She makes sure that the tip of the spring rolls fall at the exact position all the entire tray. And she would say her chanting, her blessing, wishing that, you know, that her guests, whoever that would never see her or know her name, would receive the blessing that she blessed the spring rolls. And she would make hundreds of them at the end of the day. She would raise the whole tray onto her forehead and she would say her blessing again. And to me, I think that's both about spirituality, but I think more than that, I think it's about setting intention. I think if she didn't create meanings for her job, that would be a pretty bad job. And I think, again, in that spirit of needing to find meanings in life and needing to make sense of what we do, it's such an inherent thing in Laos, and we are trying to cultivate that culture at Bidamanda and at Buri Bhavana, that even when we are polishing the glasses, it's really about an opportunity to have a conversation with someone else while you're polishing.
Well, and maybe especially, I mean, what's gorgeous about that is that anybody who has spent any time in spiritual teachings of various cultures, it always comes back to, you will find the highest achievement of spiritual or the highest moment of spiritual achievement in the most mundane routine. If you can't find it in the routine, if you don't embed it in the routine, it isn't there.
Yeah, because it's truly a journey. Yeah. And I think slowing down and allowing us to be a part of the process is the most important thing.
What's the biggest lesson that you have learned along the way in terms of on the business side, you know, things that you really got wrong completely and had to revise?
Going from a small restaurant, you know, Bidamanda is 22 tables to 10,000 square feet restaurant at Buri Bhavana. Right now, a company probably have close to 200 staff total. Mm-hmm. Going from a small, intimate community and scale that has been a tremendous learning experience. I think it's really possible to scale up, but how we do that well and how do we maintain that culture of kindness and empathy mm-hmm. and generosity, even though the scale has changed, has been a really rich experience. Even things like motivation and empowerment and trust are, you know, taking different shapes when the scales is different. So I'm learning trust in relationships and to really hold on tight in these connections and people and never forget the humanity on why we do what we do.
Talk about the Brewery Bavana and how that idea came about, because it is an eclectic set of businesses in a single space.
It truly is, and we still have a hard time trying to explain the connections with everything. But to be completely frank, I think it was never a concept. It's an expression of the people who are in our lives. My sister and I have been Amanda, and I think about 3.5 years ago, a friend, Patrick Woodson, just finished his Peace Corps work in Africa with his wife, and they were traveling to Laos. And when they moved to Raleigh to visit their parents say, you must check out Bidamanda because you say Laos is your favorite country that you visited. So they came to Table 7 and we just fell in love with each other and fell in love with our understanding of food and culture and hospitality and became really close friends. And he introduced the idea of what if we do something together. So Patrick is our business partner and responsible for all of these amazing beers that we do. And I share that story because I think it really captures the spirit of Brewery Bavana, that when you zoom into each of the complex parts, you begin to see fingerprints, you begin to see relationships and someone's narrative and someone's passion behind it. And dim sum has always been really sacred in my life growing up in Laos. And so we paired that too, and we just started to invite more people into the room. You know, that's what happened when you put creative people in one room and allow them to dream.
Apparently, you know florists and booksellers too.
Correct. Yeah, we have a library in the back. We have books on different topics that's relevant and flower shop.
Wow. When you put all these things together, and of course, that those are two spaces now, you also talked at one point about, because you're in Moore Square in Raleigh, about the space, about your relationship with land, culturally, what that means to people in Laos, and kind of how you felt about downtown Raleigh and what you had to do with that space to really make it yours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, downtown Raleigh has gone through such a tremendous evolution, and we have our challenges still. I remember when we first moved into Moore Square, you know, one of the biggest critique was we don't want to go there because Moore Square is not safe. And we have been taking an active role in altering that perception, because it's truly perception. And it's fascinating that food becomes such a generous invitation for people to say, come on, come visit our neighborhood. And seeing the completion of the park in a few months is really exciting. My sister and I also live just a few blocks out of the road. So it's really tremendous to be able to commit to that land. We have this tradition of marking the ritual component of the park. So we offer 3 incense and 2 candles and some water to the front entry and the back every day as a way to show gratitude to that neighborhood.
Your parents are here, as I said. They're watching the show even as we speak. But you've had to have their, like all of us, they're aging, and that has given you pause, and you've had to have conversations with them. Tell me about your thinking now as you imagine. You talked about this wonderful moment when you went back and said, I need your nurturing. I need you to be my mom and dad. And now they're going to need you. Talk more about what's going through your mind.
Yeah, it has been a really fascinating process, because our family has this culture where we only share with each other what would lift each other up. We share the good news. We share the positive things. But it wasn't until this trip that mom and dad, you know, really wanting to have conversations about how do we age together, how do we spend the rest of our lives thoughtfully, plan. And they have been here for a month and a half. This is the longest we have lived together in 20 years. And relearning each other's lives and mistakes and traumas and who we have become. So going through that reintroduction to each other has been really rewarding but challenging, as any other families do. And we don't know what that looks like. We don't know if that means that mom and dad would move here. We don't know if that means that my sister and I would make our life possible so that we can live partially in Laos. But the biggest honor in our culture is caring for your parents as they age. And I want to make sure that we have that honor.
What does your mother say about your recipes in your restaurant? Is she? I'm assuming she's eaten there.
She has. She loves it. Yeah. She loves it. I think she really enjoy getting to know us through what we cook, because truly it's not her food, right? It's my sister and I memory of her food.
So she doesn't wag her finger and say, what are you doing? This is not.
She has been Thai so far.
She come with any new recipes?
Yes. We have been working on you know, breakfast is a really big meal. So when I wake up, still, you know, mom and dad already are in the kitchen. So I've been writing notes on all the things that they love cooking and the things that I forgot about.
You could have breakfast food and we wouldn't know it. This could be breakfast in Laos and we wouldn't know. And
correct.
It could still be a lunch. Do you see changes in the menu? Are you as a result of this trip or anything else?
Yes. Interesting you asked that, because in spirit of change and, you know, in thinking about Bidamanda being this reflection of our life narrative, I want to make sure that the story of Bidamanda evolves over time. And it's turning 7 this year. And I think the conception of Bidamanda was at a time when we were nostalgic. We were missing home. And now that mom and dad can come and we can go home, can that story change? So I think that we're gonna see a new season of Bidamanda coming up in really celebrating mom and dad's cooking and getting even closer to that land in Laos and really bringing that to Moore Square.
Well, I'm glad you said that that's the way the change was going to go, because burgers and fries would not have been so appealing, at least to me. So that's good news. What a pleasure. So good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
Vensana Nolintha is the co-owner of Bidamanda Restaurant in Raleigh, a partner behind Brewery Bhavana. And you can find out more about the show and about the restaurants at our website, stateofthings.org. We also have a photo of the Bida and Manda at our website, stateofthings.org. A program that's produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Robin Copley is our technical director. Golden Globes last night, and we know what the Hollywood Foreign Press thought about last year's movies. What about you? Next Movies on the Radio, we want your favorite 2018 movie. Send us your pick at sot@wnc.org, or you can tweet at us at #SOTMovie. If you want your pick for the best film of 2018 to be on our next Movies on the Radio. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.